Welcome to the Investors Chronicle podcast. Today we're going to be discussing cash management and the best ways to ensure you can get the most out of your cash assets without taking on too much risk. I'm Taha Lokhandwala, Deputy Personal Finance Editor, Investors Chronicle, and joining me today are Sam Hadfield-Jones, Head of Cash at Octopus Investments, Sophie Kilvert, Private Client Manager at Seven Investment, and James Norrington, Specialist Writer, Investors Chronicle. Almost all of us have one form of cash saving product, whether it's a savings account with our current account provider or a cash ISA. Cash is, of course, a huge part of anyone's portfolio. It's the last line of defence and the first called upon asset. And over the course of our lives, most of us will experience a cash liquidity event, whether we will either need or receive a significant amount of cash, normally from property or for retirement. Yet given its importance, we don't actually seem to pay too much attention to cash. There's around £700 billion held in cash in saving accounts, mainly within the top five largest banks. Around four-fifths of savers do not change or consider changing their provider and take the interest that they're given. Sam, I think this last statistic is quite telling. We've heard about the lack of swapping being an issue in other industries like electricity and gas. Do we need to see more in cash savings?
I think absolutely we do. I think the challenge over the last 10 years that in a low rate environment, what you can get by switching for some is considered to be not worth the hassle that it takes to actually switch accounts. So I think the FCA's recent market study on the cash savings market showed that around 40% of people chose not to switch because of the fact that they didn't feel like they could get a marginally better rate elsewhere. And about half that amount, so 20%, wouldn't switch because of the hassle. I think that ends up in a stat that's along the lines of over 80% of people haven't switched their account in the last 3 years, which is an astonishing number, given the fact that a lot of banks employ a policy of dropping rates when you've been around for a long time. It's part of the business model.
So, no, given obviously people have that perception, but so can people get a better rate if they move their cash around? Is that something that is possible, or how does it work?
I think there aren't very many options out there for people to easily manage their cash. And that this is all about taking the hassle out of stuff. At Octopus, we try and use technology to take away these manual processes that otherwise make things inaccessible. So there are banks out there, particularly smaller banks, that haven't benefited from the level of free government funding that the larger banks have and are willing to pay a much better rate than the high street banks today. You're talking double, triple, even quadruple the kind of rates that you'd expect to get from a high street bank.
That's quite interesting because I think another stat that I picked up was about, you know, of that 700 billion that I mentioned earlier, 350 is in accounts that pay less than the Bank of England rate. And you mentioned these kind of smaller banks. So I think, yeah, another term that we use quite common is challenger banks.
Yes.
So what are we seeing from these challenger banks? Are we seeing better rates? Are they really challenging this market and trying to pick up kind of retail deposits?
I see the challenger bank segment split down into two. One are what we'd probably describe as digital first banks, the likes of Monzo or Starling, that are trying to deliver a customer experience led bank. And then in the kind of more traditional arena, you've got the likes of Virgin Money or Aldermore or Shawbrook. These banks are out there, they're lending, they're growing, and they have an appetite for deposits that far exceeds the average high street bank, and therefore their demand for deposits means they're willing to pay more to the end customer. Now, since the last financial crisis, people are actually really considered and interested in the £85,000 FSCS protection. So prior to that, it wasn't something people talked about or thought about. And we've seen definitely people are very, very nervous about having more than that government protected amount in any one account. Which brings me back to the point, if you want to take advantage of these challenger banks and you have more than 85,000, you're then immediately in the hassle factor of how many of these do you have to set up? Is it one? Is it two? Is it three? Is it six? And what happens at the end of a term? What happens if that bank changes their rate? What do you do then? So shamelessly plugging Octopus Cash, the idea is you have multiple banks on a platform and you can move your money between them freely. So if a bank changes their rate, you can go and get a new account. You can spread your money across lots of banks without the hassle of having to interact with lots of banks.
Okay. James, we've been looking at challenger banks quite recently in Investors Chronicle. So obviously we have the obvious thing about them trying to break into the market and offering better rates, but there's some other interesting things to look at here, isn't there, in terms of the rates they're offering?
Well, I think with challenger banks, you know, they benefited from the term funding scheme as a source of funding, which ended, I think, in February this year. I think it was set up after the EU referendum as one of Mark Carney's emergency measures. And I think, as Sam mentions, their appetite for retail deposits is because it's a cheap source of funding for them. But ultimately, they have pressures trying to compete with the markets that they're lending to as well. So there are going to be pressures. Something has to give. So how much they can continue to compete on rates That's going to be an interesting point. But I direct readers or listeners to Investors Chronicles feature that Emma Powell wrote on the 6th of April for more on that.
Okay, great. Thank you. So obviously, you know, there isn't that much switching. We've established that. So what are the risks of switching? Like, you know, there must be a reason why people aren't doing this, whether they think it's a hassle is one of them, but they must feel that there's underlying risks. Otherwise, you know, a rational investor would do this.
Yes. So I think, you know, we call it the cost of apathy. You see it across many industries. If you look at the energy sector today, you've had 10 years of really unhappy customers. And only now you're starting to see this real momentum building behind going to challenger suppliers and finding a new way of doing things. I think the last few years, given the interest rate environment we operate within and the rates available, there's been this limited incentive financially to look elsewhere and look for other providers. I think what you're seeing now with the end of the funding for lending scheme, you've seen interest rates probably fall by 60-70% since that was introduced, that falling away. I mean, interestingly, the NS&I have recently dropped some of their product limits from £1 million to £10,000, and interest rates are creeping up. So over the last 12 months, you've seen you can get a materially better rate than you could 12 months ago. And I think that's starting to pique people's interests. The return for the effort put in to swap and switch around is starting to become material. And I think that's going to increase. So I think if we're sat here in 24 months' time, there'll be a lot more people switching and proactively doing so.
Okay, great. Sophie, what conversations are you having with clients about cash and kind of cash management, and What are the things to think about when you're looking at your cash portfolio?
We spend a lot of time with our clients, particularly at the outset, talking about how much cash they should actually have. And that depends on quite a few things. It depends on how likely they are to need it, whether they're actually drawing happily from that cash at the moment, or whether it's just there for the future. It also depends on how much risk they're happy to take and comfortable with taking, for the main point. So is the cash there really just to allow them to sleep at night? Or is it there because actually they're drawing a regular income from it? And that also depends on where they put that cash for the future. So if it's just there for a point in the future where they don't know when they're going to need it, then they could actually tie it up and maybe get a better rate, as Sam was saying. But if not, if they actually need it, then it shouldn't necessarily go that much further than an instant access savings account. And unfortunately, at the moment, they're not going to get much return on that.
Okay, that's quite interesting. So with the instant access thing, there's one thing that I found quite recently when I was looking for a new cash account for my girlfriend, is that there aren't that many that pay regular interest. Now, how important is kind of looking at how often your provider pays interest? Is there a compounding thing to benefit from here?
Definitely. There's always the essence of compounding. And we all know that it can be one of the most powerful tools in investing or in cash as well. But it's a sense of looking at what's on offer, what's available, and the cost return, really, between whether it pays that cash on a regular basis, do you have to tie it up? And all those things feed into that ongoing decision as to where your cash should be.
What about tax considerations? There seems to be an understanding that you should use your tax allowances, perhaps in your eyes of the £20,000 annual allowance, to use for cash, but perhaps there might be different ways to think about this.
I see little point at the moment in having a cash ISA, in all honesty. If you've got enough money to put into an ISA that you can invest, you're much better off investing it within the ISA, using the fact that the investments within an ISA can grow tax-free, and having your cash outside an ISA. The rates you get on cash within an ISA at the moment differ little from what you can get outside an ISA. So if you've got that availability of cash that you can invest some of it, put it in an ISA every single time.
Okay, great. Sam, obviously, based on your comments earlier, you sounded like you were a proponent of being a bit more active with your cash management. So the Octopus platform aside, what are the other things that kind of, if you're just a regular saver, you can do to make sure you're getting the most out of your cash savings?
I think the primary one is if you have the energy and the enthusiasm to be proactive and look at price comparison sites, and you have the time to go and move your money around, diarise the end of terms, look for better rates, you will constantly be able to get a better rate. It's just that trade-off between effort and reward. And I think, again, in this low interest rate environment, coming back to your ISA point, I think something along the lines of 40 billion will still go into cash ISAs this year in the UK. That's about over 60% of the ISA market. Putting a tax wrapper around something that's not earning you any money is a real waste of this amazing government scheme that's in place to incentivize savers to actually go out there and build their wealth. If you're earning less than inflation, you should be thinking about what else is there out there. I think there are alternatives between, you know, going for a stocks and shares ISA, but, you know, the recently launched innovative finance ISA is something that is starting to get traction, and that's where you can wrap up your peer-to-peer loans in an ISA.
Is that suitable for cash savings, or is that too risky? So
it's, I think it comes down to that question, especially if you've got a professional advisor. It's about looking at your portfolio, looking at your asset allocation, and working out what you need in cash and what you need to be deployed to be earning a return. Now, having an alternative between cash and stocks and shares is a nice extra string to your bow, I think. Now, it's not a cash alternative, but it gives investors and savers a new kind of angle to look at.
I think some of the problem now for people who are, could be investors, but are at the more cautious end of the scale, is where on earth they do invest, with so little on return on cash at the moment, but also actually the real risk of holding too much fixed interest with yields as they are. It's a real problem if you don't want to take that much risk with your money.
Okay. James, is there anything else we need to be thinking about here with any of the options? We were chatting about structured products a little bit earlier.
I think that, you know, so structured products are probably a longer term. They've got counterparty risk, and the issuers will want you to deposit your money for a certain amount of time. And again, there's possibly the risk of loss isn't so great, provided the issuer doesn't go pop, which can't be discounted. We all remember 10 years ago. But, you know, what that involves is a product that might track an instrument, so the FTSE 100, but you give up a portion of the returns in order to have your principal guaranteed. Again, it's probably, for cash, your main concern, I would argue, is still probably liquidity and funding your day-to-day needs. But again, it's another thing which on the risk spectrum probably sits between outright equity investment and cash somewhere.
Okay. What about technologies that have a part to play here? So, you know, we're discussing the ways that your everyday saver can move their cash around. Is there anything out there that might help them?
I think Sam's covered off in terms of what asset managers can do in terms of the service that they can provide, make things easier for their customers and clients. But I guess, you know, people were looking about things going in the future. What could we get from blockchain and cryptocurrencies? Is there anything there? I mean, I'd refer to the sort of the Barclays Equity Gilt Study, where they actually did a section on this earlier in the year. And there's some interesting uses potentially around theft, asset custody, and secure settlements and payments. And maybe we'll be using it for conveyancing of houses. But in terms of, you know, our purposes of cash holdings investments, I think, you know, maybe someone's got to come up with a solution.
We're left a bit wanting in that situation then. Okay, so we talked about banks and challenger banks when it comes to cash management. Are there any other options out there? We mentioned kind of premium bonds and national saving and investments. Sophie, what do we think about these products?
They certainly have their place. Obviously, backed by the government, they're nice and safe. And in fact, they do form a big part of some of my clients' portfolios. My mum absolutely loves premium bonds, and she celebrates every time she gets a £25 win. When you actually calculate the returns on them, they're not great, but they are safe for your assets. And when you're not getting much on cash held elsewhere, a bit of premium bond alongside investments, alongside cash holding elsewhere, you can't go too wrong with it.
Do we think people are going to be significantly affected by the in the cut in the allowance?
Certainly, yes. I think reducing it from where it was to where it is now, £1 million to 10,000, is a huge change. And I think it will incentivize people to go and look elsewhere. So certainly from our perspective, the peace of mind, the protection, the government guarantee, a lot of the clients that use the products that we've built are there to protect their money. It's capital preservation is the top requirement for them, and they're willing to forgo, you know, a stocks and shares type return because they just want peace of mind, particularly if they're later in life, maybe they're in a drawdown period, accumulation, you know, as a retiree, you need a pot of cash to be stable. So yeah, I think you'll see a lot of people looking elsewhere for other products that can fill that gap.
Okay, so there are kind of funds you can buy on your everyday platforms, Argos, Lansdowne, AJ Bell, etc., that invest in cash-like products. And, you know, these aim to provide a better yield and return compared to what you just get from your everyday account. Sophie, what do you think about these funds? How often do they come up in conversation with clients?
They do come up a bit. That I think they definitely had their place a few years ago when interest rates were higher. Now, the return that you can get on a money market fund or a cash fund, to be honest, you can pretty much get it on an instant access. They're so low that there's not a great deal of point. There's normally a charge there might even be a charge if you hold it on certain platforms, in which case you're getting a negative return. So look carefully before using a money market fund. I mean, I guess you could look at also looking at some very short dated gilt funds or something like that, but even then the return it's pretty low at the moment. And then you've got the capital risk of holding fixed interest as well.
No, absolutely. It's funny you say that. So I just pulled down some stats before we came down. So the Royal London Cash Plus Fund, which I think is one of the biggest cash funds available, over 3 years has returned you 1.59%. If you got the Bank of England base rate, you would have got 1.19% compounded. That's obviously not... So that 1.59 is net of charges, but you are paying 15 basis points, not including the platform fee. So that, you know, some serious things to consider. You also have to think about what these things invest in. James, you've been looking a bit more deep dive as to what these cash funds hold?
I haven't really done deep dive, Taha, but just as a general point, the money market, it's a lot more complex than just, we just use this cover all term cash. There are several different instruments that traders and managers will be looking at. Bankers' acceptances, which are short-term credit investments issued by firms and guaranteed by banks, as opposed to commercial paper, which is unsecured promissory note issued by firms. There's certificates of deposit, which are time deposits with a bank, and T-bills, which are ultra-safe short-term government bonds. So there's quite a myriad of instruments that are used to create these funds, and that would affect the risk profile of them. So as well as credit risk, liquidity risk, and obviously, you know, the risk of inflation, which inflation, as you pointed out, has outstripped these funds anyway. There's rollover risk. So the principles of coupon investments, if you're looking at some of the shorter dated bond funds, those are probably the safest. They need to be reinvested at different rates. So when we're at ultra low rates, the managers were probably, and they weren't able to reinvest in similar bonds with a high coupon. And they'd have been investing in shorter term riskier securities. So they might have gone along the risk curve to riskier commercial paper. So there was a lot there. And actually, so as Sophie says, for the return you're getting, you know, you might as well have it cash on deposit for the last, you know, the last few years. But obviously rates rising, we'll see how long that lasts with potential trade wars heating up.
Indeed. It's interesting to know. I know, especially the other thing that I found interesting about this Royal London Fund was that over 3 years, depending on when you went in and when you went out, if you pulled your money, you could have lost 0.05%, which isn't much, but is more than enough when it's a cash fund and you're not supposed to be losing anything. So,
and if you look to what the end customer is looking for here, it's peace of mind, it's comfort, that cash and cash equivalents phrase, you've just read out a list there, right? That's not easy for your average investor to understand. And if you can't understand it, how are you going to get that peace of mind and comfort?
Okay, Sophie, you briefly touched on these short duration funds. So back into 2016, the industry saw quite a few launches of these products, and asset managers are going around kind of marketing these as cash equivalents. Do you buy into that?
No, I don't. Not anymore. I think with yields where they are, there's a real risk that as we see yields rise again, the capital value of the actual bond that it's holding will fall. And so while you might have picked up a bit of yield over the last couple of years, that capital value will fall. And that is not what you want from, as Sam was saying, a cash equivalent. That's not what it's there for. I just think it's really, really difficult for cash savers at the moment.
As a kind of rounding off point, Sam, what's your one piece of advice to kind of eke more out of your cash?
I think people need to look elsewhere, look away from the high street and have a look at what products are out there that allow them to spread their money, get a better rate of return, and ideally use some technology along the way to enhance their yield and protect themselves at the same time.
Okay, Sophie, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would controversially say just check about the amount of cash you're holding, because some people hold a lot of cash they don't necessarily need to. Yes, it gives you peace of mind, but there is an opportunity cost for holding that cash, particularly when you're getting below the rate of inflation. It's not just the opportunity cost, there's a real cost that in 10 years' time, that cash you hold isn't going to be worth the same as it is now if inflation bites. So check the amount of cash you're holding. Is it actually what you need, or is it too much, and can you do something different with it?
Great, thank you. Some really, really good pieces of advice there. That's all we have time for today. So thank you very much for listening, and be smart with your cash.